Think of all the books that have shaped who you are. Now, let's advance the conversation. In this podcast, I'll dig into topics that affect how you see the world by talking with authors who write about them. This is Cap Radio Reads. I'm Donna Epidone. Today, you'll hear my conversation with Terry E. Givens, author of Radical Empathy, Finding a Path to Bridging Racial Divides. Racism is not inevitable. That's a recurring theme in Radical Empathy. It isn't inevitable, and it isn't the norm. Even though racism has been a hot topic for decades, and equity has still not come to fruition, there is hope, because we can all learn radical empathy. Terry Givens' background as a college professor and administrator is evident in her writing. She provides attributions and endnotes, as well as suggested reading. At the end of her chapter, she offers suggestions on how we can develop new perspectives on race and equity. My conversation with Terry Givens started with definitions to distinguish between empathy and radical empathy.
Empathy is putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, and, you know, and being able to, you know, experience what they are experiencing in life. But I realize, you know, I have empathy, and isn't that great? But I realize, wait, you know, you can have empathy, but that really doesn't change things, especially in the climate we're seeing in our country today, in the longstanding issues of race and discrimination. And so I said, well, really, we need to have radical empathy, which means taking action and creating change. So for me, it's not just being able to say, oh, I understand your experience and, you know, maybe I'm compassionate about it, but this country really needs to start taking action and creating change in a way that improves the situation for everybody.
When did you first come to understand that difference?
Well, I don't know that there was a, you know, particular, you know, stroke of lightning that hit me, but
you didn't write it down in your calendar?
No, darn. I think that for me, it was an evolution, right? So I start the book actually with the passing of my father and learning that, you know, he died from a heart attack, and learning that just being an African-American male is a risk factor for having a heart attack, and unfortunately passing away from a heart attack. And so that started, you know, getting the wheels spinning. And, over time, I'm a researcher as well. So within my own academic research, I was seeing these issues of race and discrimination, not only here in the US, but in my research in Europe. And so, you know, but what really spurred it was, you know, the various, you know, killings of young African-American men and so on, that really hit me. And I was like, you know, how can we get to a situation where we are trying to really bridge those divides? So, you know, empathy, how can people understand how it feels to fear for your child? You know, I have two boys. And so I started thinking more and more about empathy. But then I was like, we have to take it a step further. You know, and so I started thinking carefully, what does it take? And so I came up with these six steps to radical empathy. The first step is, just being willing to be vulnerable. And I model that throughout this book. You know, I'm telling my story and being very vulnerable. And then the second step is, you know, being grounded in who you are. And so that was something, I think it's when I really became grounded in who I am, that I started to have that sense of what it really means to have empathy. Because, you know, we really have, you know, and it's also being open to, you know, step three is being open to the experiences of others. So that, you know, that empathy is understanding yourself and having empathy for yourself, as well as practicing empathy and having empathy for others. And then the next step is taking action. And then finally, creating change and building trust. And I think that's a path that our country can be on, and that we as individuals have to be on to really create change.
It was rather courageous of you to be as vulnerable as you are in this book, because you create this path separately from your personal story, but you do use your life story to walk us through the path. Why did you decide to go that route and lay your life out for us?
Well, the first reason is that I want people to understand that every person's, every African-American person's experience in this country is unique. You know, I read a ton of books and articles and so on. And, you know, I was like, well, you know, I kind of have a unique experience because, first of all, there aren't that many Black people from Spokane, Washington. You know, I almost titled this book, you know, Growing Up Black and Catholic in Spokane, Washington. but I wanted to share somebody's experience that people maybe, you know, hadn't, you know, experienced before. And but also it was a journey for me to really dig in and, you know, so in some ways I wrote this book for myself to understand, you know, the choices my parents made. You know, why did we decide to grow up in Spokane, or why did they decide they wanted us to grow up in Spokane, Washington, a place when I was born in 1964 that was less than 1% Black? You know, what were the experiences of my father, you know, in the military, and how it, you know, those connected to my life? And so I really wanted to do a deep dive and really try to understand. And there was, you know, one book in particular that really helped me with that process, which is Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns. And, you know, I have to be honest, you know, part of me was kind of angry with my parents for, you know, deciding to have us grow up in a place where we didn't have a lot of interaction with other Black people. But then when I read The Warmth of Other Suns, I realized, you know, they were trying to create a new beginning, you know, a new environment for us where we could be successful in a, you know, country that was predominantly white, especially at that time. And, you know, so they were trying to create a better future for us. And, you know, I at one point, I remember I was writing a blog post and, you know, I was looking at the fact that, you know, my grandfather was a sharecropper. You know, my mother had an eighth grade education and was a seamstress. And here I am, a PhD. You know, I see these t-shirts around, you know, we are our ancestors' wildest dreams. And, you know, so I appreciate much better now the choices that my parents made. I still may not like them, but I have to have empathy for my parents, right? And I have to have empathy for myself and the way I was raised and all of, and but also to understand that and how that impacted me. And, you know, so anyway, I go on to talk about, we can get into this a little bit, but, you know, internalized oppression and all of that.
We will go there. The story about Spokane is interesting, because they did consciously move there, wanting a different and better life for their children than what they experienced. But you didn't realize that right away. How long did it take you to develop that empathy for them and see where they were coming from in that move?
Well, really, it was in some ways in the process of writing. Well, I think when I read Isabel Wilkerson's book, and I probably read that book about 5 years ago, but it was in the process of writing this book that I really, you know, developed a better understanding, because I started looking at, you know, so each chapter not only covers my story, but I include the data and, you know, the different factors that influenced, you know, the things that lead to structural racism, all of that. And so it was in the process of doing this that I really feel like I came to full circle to understanding why my parents made the choices that they did.
Your dad made some choices in the military. Not everybody gets to make their own choices in the military. True. So some of it was presented to him as, here's what you'll do. But he made some choices too. And those affected your upbringing in a positive way?
Yeah, I would say so, because, well, the big decision was where he was going to live once he retired from the military, right? And so we were, you know, he was stationed at Fairchild Air Force Base outside of Spokane. And, but, you know, my parents, you know, one of the decisions they made was to buy a home in Spokane. And then we moved for a couple of years to Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and then moved back. So, you know, all my upbringing, even though they had moved around the country and to a certain extent the world while he was in the military, you know, it's really interesting. You know, they met in Los Angeles, you know, they'd lived in England, you know, Texas, Louisiana, and then, you know, Washington State and Spokane. And yet they chose, you know, they made that decision to be in Spokane. And
not just because it was the last, but right. It's, they saw something else there that they wanted.
Right. And I think, it, you know, I visited my father's hometown of Leedsdale, Pennsylvania, which is outside of Pittsburgh. And when I visited there, I realized, oh, well, this is what he grew up with, was, you know, very, it was very similar to Spokane. And the interesting thing is, you know, I've seen a picture of his graduation from Leechdale High School, and he was the class president, but there were only like two or three other Black people in his class. So, you know, even back then, you know, he might have been, you know, the only, well, not the only, but one of a few Black students in his class, but he was the class president. So, you know, he was a leader even back then. And so I think that influenced a lot of his experiences in the military.
It didn't take me long, because it's on the cover of the book, to see how interesting the subtitle is. The book is called Radical Empathy, but the subtitle is Finding a Path to Bridging Racial Divides. It's very delicate phrasing, mm-hmm. Finding a path. It's not making a grand entrance on an interstate highway. I mean, you allow for the fact that this is going to be some social enlightenment that we can engage in, but it's going to be gradual.
That's
right.
Is
that how you see it?
It's a process. And,
it's a process.
You know, I actually do workshops for people. And I tell them it's not something I can jump in and give you an hour long workshop and then you're going to come out enlightened. You know, there's a lot of work involved. And that was also part of the purpose of writing this book, is helping people. I mean, I looked at the process I went through. And then, you know, thinking about somebody who hasn't had the lived experience of racism in this country, you know, that's why empathy is so important. And that's why telling my stories. And, you know, the other thing I want to make sure I mention is that, you know, telling stories is part of that process. And being able to tell your story is part of that process. Because it's through telling stories that it's easier to empathize with somebody when they, you know, instead of me just coming and saying, oh, I've been discriminated against, you know, it's better if I tell a story of, you know, this is how, you know, my experience and this is how I felt when it happened and so on. So there's real power in storytelling. And I really drew on the work of Brené Brown and various other, and obviously there's a huge storytelling tradition in the African-American community as well. And so storytelling is incredibly powerful for helping people to have empathy, but also to allow us to tell our stories in a way that is meaningful to us.
As you teach the importance of storytelling, how do you help students or participants in workshops to differentiate between kinds of storytelling? Because there is the kind of storytelling that enhances and adds richness to history, but there's also the kind of storytelling that inadvertently perpetuates a myth or something that we don't want to continue. How do you guide people to the right kind of storytelling to make sure we move forward?
Well, it requires, you know, first of all, it has, you know, in this context, it has to be your story, right? And that's why the first step is willingness to be vulnerable, because you have to be, and even then, you know, it's kind of finding that truth in your own story, right? Because you have to be vulnerable to be willing to say, well, you know, I did grow up in this really white neighborhood, and I really, you know, I never really knew any other people of color. And, you know, to me, it's just normal to walk into a room and, you know, have it be all white people, all white men, or whatever it may be. And, you know, I use the example oftentimes when people ask me, you know, how can I practice empathy? And, you know, one of the ways is just walk through your neighborhood. Who do you see? Who's there? Who's not there? And so it's really a process in storytelling of telling your own story from your own perspective, but, you know, so that people can understand where you're coming from. And it's not about trying to tell a story about, you know, well, this community became the way it is just because people didn't, you know, people of color didn't want to live here. You know, that's not telling your story. So that's one example.
Because of your background as a researcher and an academic, it's not surprising that your book is filled with, in addition to you telling your story, a lot of quotes from other people, a lot of quotes from people who are great writers and great thinkers and have written on this topic. You include a quote about bias from Jennifer Eberhardt, which ends with the first step towards ending those disparities is to discard the assumption that they are inevitable.
That's right.
How do we do that?
It's that process of, you know, being willing to see what other people are experiencing. So then again, I come back to empathy, but, you know, it's the interesting thing there is that the African-American community has always been hopeful, right? And so we don't see this situation as inevitable or, you know, assume that it can't be changed. And so by, you know, having people understand our experience and see why we have, you know, I mean, we have children, we have hope for the future. We want to see things change. And, you know, those assumptions are often based on a very narrow perspective of, you know, what our communities and our country is about. And so it's by expanding and opening our minds to the experiences of others that really helps us to understand, no, we can change. It's not inevitable.
There was another quote that came right after that one that is a really good example of some of the differences that you're talking about here. That the system of slavery is still with us in so many ways. There are still a lot of people who follow that, who believe that, that see a continuation of that by choice. But Nicole Hannah-Jones brings up the legacy of slavery and calls it a system so grotesque that Nazi Germany would later take inspiration from it for its own racist policies. Mm-hmm. An important quote because she takes what white people may not see about slavery and turns it in a way to show how it was used against white people.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, I've been doing further. I have another book coming out soon called The Roots of Racism, where I delve even further into that history of the connections between, you know, U.S. slavery and Jim Crow laws and, you know, the Nazis genocide. And there's a book, there's several books out there that talk about this. But, you know, the last chapter of my book talks about, you know, how Germany and has kind of come to a you know, truth and reconciliation as well as South Africa. But I mean, to come back to that quote, you know, it's really important to understand that, you know, that there's tendrils out there. Like you were saying, you know, there's still people who, you know, see dehumanize people. And that's what it comes back to is that especially if you look at the history, I spent a lot of time in the National Museum, African American Heritage and Culture or History and Culture. And, you know, I encourage anybody who can, you know, when things are easy, you know, not so difficult with COVID, to get to Washington, D.C. and to see that museum, because it really gives you the perspective of how this was an inhumane system and how some of it is perpetuated to this day. And it's that dehumanization that was part of the whole process of slavery.
You say anti-racism has to be top down and bottom up. How does that work? What does that look like?
Well, that's why I focus on the individual, because we've been had, you know, the civil rights movement, we've had, you know, which did create huge change. But it seems like, especially since the 80s, we've kind of stalled out that, you know, we're even seeing some backsliding on policies and so on. And so I really believe that we each of us has to take individual responsibility. And that's why I say it's that day-to-day racism and understanding structural discrimination that is so important. And, you know, I'm seeing that change happen. You know, when I did a workshop just a couple weeks ago at McGill University, and, you know, for the people involved, they said it was, you know, it was transformative. It completely changed the way they thought about these issues and, you know, that how important empathy is. And so, you know, it comes back to this issue of, you know, how do we create change in a way that is going to fundamentally change the system of, you know, structural racism and the broader issues that are perpetuated because we don't see it, right? I talk about living in the sea of white supremacy because we're all breathing. I have to come now to the term of internalized oppression again, because what happens often is we internalize the dehumanization, the negativity and all of that. And so, you know, I believe that's what happened to my parents when they thought, well, you know, it's better for our kids. They didn't say this to me in any way, but, you know, in their actions, you know, they didn't want us to be around other Black kids because, you know, they just didn't think it was good for us to hang out with these other Black kids and other, you know, we only had a few Black families in Spokane that we would hang out with. And so they internalized this idea that, you know, Black is bad. And, you know, that's something I struggled with because it's like, wait, my parents don't want us to hang out with other Black people, but I'm Black. So what does that say about me? And so I struggled with that for a long time and finally realized, no, I am, you know, Black is beautiful. I'm a good person, you know, and all of that. And once I came to that realization, I understood that I had to change. I had to break out of those structures that were, you know, causing even me to internalize the oppression. And so we all need to understand how that impacts us. That's why I see it as a process. That's why it's so difficult, because we just live in these systems where it's normal that I'm the only Black person in this neighborhood, you know, or it's normal that we, you know, the Black kids and the brown kids are going to a school that's not as good as, you know, where the other kids are going. And, you know, that's not normal. You know, we need to look at that and say, why is this happening? And so that's why I tell people, start with your own neighborhood, start with your own, you know, looking around you, you know, try to understand the history. That's why I recommend so many of these books, like The Color of Law, that explains, you know, how racial segregation was perpetuated by, you know, redlining and laws and real estate agents keeping people out of neighborhoods, you know, and that happens to this day. We keep seeing these stories pop up about, you know, like the story in Marin of the family that got their house appraised and, you know, they had a white friend stand in for them and all of a sudden the appraisal went up. So, you know, this stuff is happening every day.
Did you truly not experience any racism as a growing up in Spokane?
Oh, no, I did. No, I did. I don't want to say no. But, you know, it wasn't a lot of blatant racism. I would say, no, the kind of racism I experienced in Spokane, I don't know that I even understood it when I was a kid. It was more that, you know, there was a sense that, you know, like when I was, you know, I was smart in school, you know, my teachers were surprised and, you know, they didn't have, you know, very high expectations for me and my siblings and things like that. But, you know, the Black community was so small that I think that you didn't see, you know, and actually, to be fair, I do have a relative who was put in jail in Spokane and didn't come out alive. So, you know, we have our own family situation where, you know, we don't know what happened and we probably never will. But we assume that there was something happened to him in jail that caused him to pass away. And so, you know, for me personally, I never got pulled over by the police. You know, but that's the thing is I had to prove my, so I guess the way it comes about in a kind of way that you don't think about necessarily is I always felt I had to prove myself. And my parents always told me, you know, you have to be twice as good to get half the credit. And so I internalized that. And it's like, okay, well, I have to do way better than my white friends and fellow students in order to get the same credit or attention. And so I, you know, that just pushed me to work harder and harder. But, you know, it's funny how we really, like I said, it's internalized and you don't necessarily see it as racism when it's happening. Or, you know, it's funny, we didn't even have the term microaggressions, you know, when I was a kid in the 1970s. So I think it's almost like you have an expectation that you're going to be treated like a Black person, right? And so you don't necessarily see it as overt or, you know, racism when it's happening to you.
Especially when you're a kid, you think,
yes,
oh, the teacher is just saying something about me. Maybe he or she says that to all the students. You don't
That's
necessarily
right.
see racism. You don't necessarily see that you're being singled out.
That's right.
In any way. When you talk about the top down and bottom up perspective, how does that look in a classroom?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So where you have somebody who is in power in front mm-hmm. of the classroom, and you have a group of people of various ages who are not in power, how can that top down, bottom up work?
Well, the way I look at that is, you know, first of all, I as a teacher, if I'm the teacher, you know, I have to be open to understanding the different perspectives of the students. And so I have to be willing to understand that each student is an individual, that they are coming in with their own set of issues. And you know, I call it, you know, I hate to call it baggage because, but, you know, each student has their, because it's not a negative thing per se. It's just that each student has their own set of experiences. And so I, as a teacher, have to be willing to be open to those experiences and understanding that, you know, they're each unique individuals. And, you know, the big part of it is not making assumptions, right? So I should not make assumptions about any of these kids. I should let them, you know, teach me who they are and expect, you know, the best out of them. And then for the students, you know, that bottom up part of it is that we need to allow students to be themselves, to, you know, not have to worry about, you know, I mean, I shouldn't be sitting in a classroom worried about, oh my goodness, you know, is my teacher going to treat me differently because, you know, I don't look like the other kids, or, you know, it's the same with, you know, I talk about bridging racial divides, but really this is more than that. It's really about bridging all kinds of divides. And this is, you know, for the disabled student, for the LGBTQI student, for, you know, any student, you know, I have a son who has ADHD, you know, for any student has these experiences. And so to a certain extent, we need to empower the students to be able to speak up for themselves and say, you know, hey, this is who I am. But then the teacher has to be ready to, from the, you know, say, I am open to who you are. And, you know, we can work together to understand each other and build that trust.
It's probably happening in some classrooms more than in others, and
absolutely,
maybe difficult to gauge. Do you, as an educator, see that education is going in that direction?
Well, you know, so there's different aspects of this, and I think, you know, K through 12 is different than higher ed, because I, as a professor, you know, it's, you know, these are students who are, you know, 18 to 25-ish, and they're at a different stage of life. And so I do believe that there's different ways to approach it at different ages. And so, you know, I wouldn't say there's any one approach that's going to work. But I think what I can say is that as teachers, we have to be willing to understand that, for example, I've changed my teaching methods. You know, I used to just, you know, okay, I'm going to lecture, we're going to have a midterm, we're going to have an exam. And now I understand that all students learn differently. And so, okay, I'm going to give them options. You know, they can take an exam, or they can write a paper, or, you know, and that students, you know, excel at different things. So, you know, when I do my assignments, I give them options. And I don't just impose, you know, a one size fits all approach to learning. And so in many ways, it's the same thing in society. We can't, you know, when we're out in society, we don't want to put people in boxes. You know, we want to give people, you know, the space to be who they are.
At the end of every chapter, you give us homework.
Yes.
So we could tell you're an educator. The homework, they're really just some helpful exercises. You can go about this step of this process by doing this. And they're very mm-hmm. useful. They're explained very nicely. They're very useful. And they're at the end of most of the chapters. I'm wondering which of those pieces of homework you're still working on.
All of them.
Yeah.
No, actually, probably the one I work on the most is, you know, when I enter a room, I look to see who is there and who isn't there. And so it's something that, you know, and I'm not trying to be hypersensitive. It's more, thinking, because I think in academia, and I was guilty of this, we have a tendency to think, oh, well, I only want to work with people who come from top institutions, or when I'm hiring, things like that. The first thing I'm going to look at is what school they went to. Well, I have had to develop some humility and understand that, look, I've spent the last few years really diving into higher ed and the ways that these biases impact, our ability to be effective, not just effective teachers, but effectively reaching our students more broadly, from admissions to, all the different components. And so I really have to work hard to make sure that I don't let, these biases seep in. And so when I, it's not just, looking to see who's there. It's like, am I showing bias by, not, maybe being dismissive of somebody because of where they come from or anything like that. So I work hard to make sure that I, it's funny because, there's the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But I call it the platinum rule. It's do unto others as they would like to have done unto them.
Oh. Yeah.
So it's taking a different perspective, right? It's not, I want everybody to treat me the way I want to be treated. No, it's, I want to treat everybody the way they want to be treated, And so, but that requires understanding. And so the first thing I try to do is not make assumptions. I could easily walk into I work with, high level administrators and institutions. I could easily walk into one of those rooms. Okay. Oh God, here we go again. A bunch of white guys. But no, I have to give them credit and say, look, they are here to work with me. I'm not going to stereotype them because I don't want to be stereotyped. So I have to be willing to say, and this is something, I have to work on constantly, is say, no, I am not going to make assumptions about these people just because I have certain ways of thinking about, what their background, and it was interesting. I was having a discussion with a friend just yesterday, and he said he was listening to a podcast. And, he didn't know who the person was, he'd heard that he'd played basketball and, he's in the NBA and, he lived in Chicago and all this stuff. So, in his mind, he imagined, and his accent was kind of neutral. So, he's envisioning, this must be a black guy. And he said, and then it turns out it was Arne Duncan, who is a white guy. And so, I was like, oops, I got to change my, I can't make assumptions about people.
So. I have to ask you about assimilation, because you brought up the damned if you do, damned if you don't, your words,
right.
As far as assimilation goes. And that was something that seemed to be given to you early in life, that mm-hmm. feeling that it's not going to be good either way. But you're certainly not the first person who has said that. Mm-hmm. I have talked to other writers who have said that. It's been said by people in my own family who grew up in other countries and came to the U.S. Assimilation, damned if you do and damned if you don't. And after I thought about it for a while, I thought there are more people trying to assimilate than there are people who they're assimilating to.
Right.
The majority now seems to be the people who are trying to assimilate. The percentages are even off mm-hmm. a little bit. Why is that so out of whack?
Because we have, it comes back to this way we internalize norms, right? And so this is why, if we're internalizing what the norm is, then we're always trying to reach to what we think that norm is. It's not necessarily what the reality is. And so, I've lived in places where, there are large, minority populations, but it also has to do with power dynamics, right? And if we look who is in power, then, we still have a problem with getting women on boards of directors and as CEOs and things like that. And so we're still in a culture where white men, are predominate in all of these spaces. And, we look at the Congress and all these different, city and state level government. I mean, the locus of power is still, in these white spaces. And so if we want some of that, we have to be willing to accommodate to those spaces and to be able to function in those spaces. But on the other hand, we want to retain our own culture. And, you know, we see, obviously, you know, African-American culture has seeped into every aspect of our society. It's interesting. If you haven't seen it, you have to watch the Netflix series High on the Hog. That was another one of those things that just really impressed me. And, you know, my mom's from Louisiana, so, you know, I grew up with some of that cooking. And then realizing the connections to Africa, you know, that okra is called gumbo in Africa and on the West Coast, and, you know, places like Benin and Ivory Coast and so on. So, you know, it's really fascinating to see those connections, but then it also, you know, helps us understand, you know, that's why we have to take pride in the ways that our cultures have interacted and blended and mixed, but also that, you know, we still have to deal with these power differentials and dynamics.
You have a chapter on healthcare, mm-hmm. in which you point out that Black pain matters and the inequities that happen in healthcare. Fear of doctors for a very good historical set of reasons. Mm-hmm. How do we get past that? How does that particular industry and that particular field get past that and better serve people of color?
Absolutely. And yeah, obviously we talk about the Tuskegee experiment around syphilis and how Black men weren't treated. And actually, that's when people are vaccine hesitant, I tell them, look, they withheld treatment, so we want to get vaccinated. But, you know, it goes so deep into the culture of, you know, medicine and how doctors are trained. And, you know, it just shocked me when I started really digging into this that, you know, a high percentage of white medical students think Black people don't experience pain in the same way that because our, you know, our skin is thicker or something like that. It's just crazy that this stuff is still perpetuated. And so what we have to do, and this word comes up a lot in when I'm doing my workshops, and we have to be intentional. And so when we are, I know there are lots of people working in this arena to change the way we do medical school, the way that doctors are trained. You know, I have a friend who's a medical doctor, and we came up with a checklist of things, you know, that every doctor should have. So when a patient of color or even just a woman walks in, that they know to ask certain questions and that they check themselves and that they say, okay, I am going to be intentional about not making assumptions. I mean, I talk about my own experience with endometriosis where, you know, it took me years to find a doctor who would acknowledge that the pain I was experiencing was probably related to, you know, endometriosis, even though my older sister had it. And he said, you know, I bet you've had a lot of doctors who told you that Black women don't get endometriosis. And I was like, well, yeah, they didn't believe me when I said that I probably had it. And I did. And luckily I got treated and was able to eventually have children because of it. Not because of the endometriosis, but because of the treatment. And so, but, you know, there's almost this expectation that we can, you know, handle all this pain. And it's just horrible the way that doctors withhold pain medication and so on. So it's really a serious issue. And like I said, there are a lot of educators out there and people, you know, doctors who are working on this and trying to create this change. But a lot of it, again, is about being intentional. It's about and acknowledging that we have these biases. That's the most critical thing here, is for us to acknowledge that these biases exist, to acknowledge them, and to be intentional about having to overcome them.
What is racial battle fatigue? How can you help us to understand that?
Yes, racial battle fatigue, also known as, you know, well, the emotional labor comes first and then the racial battle fatigue. It's the, you know, it's this constant, you know, every day going out into the world, having to experience the microaggressions and, you know, and for those of us who are working in this field to try to create change, it's the ongoing challenges and struggles and, you know, dealing with people who don't believe us and having to, you know, prove yet again. Yeah. And that's what a lot of times, you know, they call it microaggressions, but, you know, it's that the constant, you know, look, you know, I don't need to have to always be correcting you or you know, I always say, you know, there's the classic thing, you know, you're the only Black person in the room and the race comes up and everybody turns towards you as if you're the representation, you know, the representative for all Black people. So getting past that, you know, doing the work is so critical for this because, you know, for us to get past this racial battle fatigue, it's going to take people of goodwill who are willing to do the work, to read my book, to read Ibram Kendi's book, you know, Stand from the Beginning, to read Brené Brown, to read, you know, all the different people who are talking about, you know, things like vulnerability and understanding our history. And so the racial battle fatigue, you know, I see this all the time on social media. I'm on Twitter and Facebook and be like, yeah, you know, Google it. If you have a question, instead of going and asking your Black friend, Google it first, read, you know, do some of the work. I wrote this book, so I don't, you know, it's so funny. Somebody's like, well, you know, did you write this because you want other Black people to be vulnerable? I'm like, no, I wrote this book so other Black people don't have to be vulnerable. You know, I put myself out there. So hopefully people will read it and understand, oh, well, I didn't know maybe my Black friend is going through this. You know, I thought they were pretty, you know, happy in life. And so, you know, it's I felt really driven to do this in a way that really tries to educate people and help them understand. But, you know, for people of color, for Black people, we also have to understand that we have all these pressures on us, that the internalized oppression, the ways that we have to constantly. So the racial battle fatigue is real. And but, you know, I just work through it and realize that the ultimate goal is very important, not just for me, but for my children and my nieces and nephews and all, so that, you know, hopefully someday we can, you know, gradually work towards a system that is not, you know, built against us.
How about restorative and transitional justice? How are those part of the radical empathy conversation?
They're a critically important one. So in a sense, the book moves from the individual to, you know, what can we do at the national and international level?
Societal level.
Exactly. So, we can learn from societies like what happened in Germany after World War II and their path to truth and reconciliation. South Africa, I mean, you know, they still have issues there, but they did, you know, they did go through this process of truth and reconciliation. And I was very lucky to be able to visit South Africa and go to the museums there and understand the history of apartheid and how that impacted people and how they came, they're still trying to come out of it. But, this idea of truth and reconciliation is, it's a very high level, you know, it's something that we can aspire to. And there are processes in place. I mentioned several processes. And, you know, it's very interesting to be in Canada at this time as these issues of the Indigenous, graves are being uncovered and at the boarding schools and all of this. And of course, a lot of this happened in the U.S. as well. And so it's really interesting to see the approach of truth and reconciliation to say, yes, we must acknowledge the past. We must acknowledge. And that's something this country has not done. We're seeing the statues coming down, but we need that truth and reconciliation process to happen in a way that we all understand how the past is still impacting the present. You know, people want to say, oh, you know, why do we have to always talk about racism? Because it's never gone away. I mean, just look at our prisons. Look at the issues with the police. Look at all these different things that, are showing us that structural discrimination and racism still exists in this country. And the only way to really move past it in a way that will allow us to really create concrete change is to accept responsibility. Not that I'm not saying that my neighbors are racist or anything. They obviously are not, but we all must understand how, you know, I heard a discussion about privilege today that really struck me that, you know, it's not privilege in the sense that, you're privileged and wealthy. It's privilege in the sense that you are getting something that, you know, my children don't, you know, your children are getting something my children don't get don't get the benefit of the doubt or whatever it may be because of the difference of their race, which race is a social construct. Again, we always have to start these discussions with that race is a social construct. It does not exist. We are genetically the same.
Exactly. But Germany and South Africa are interesting examples to use. They have the documents on paper mm-hmm. that say that we acknowledge this and we will not do this again. But are they truly living that in a way that's different than what's happening in this country?
Well, you know, yes and no. It's interesting because I use the example of, from the book Learning from the Germans. And, you know, and I've been to Germany. I spent a lot of time in Germany. And, you know, I see in their education system that, you know, teaching about the Holocaust is you know, very critical. And I remember when I, you know, spent my first long period of time in Germany and talking to young people, how they said, yeah, you know, we it's in our faces all the time. But there's, you know, there's issues with it. And I talk about that in the book. And so nobody's perfect at this. And, you know, we never will be. But the fact that they are making that effort, I think, is really one of the critical components, is that they are making the effort to say, yes, we acknowledge the history, and they make mistakes. There was this Bundeswehr, German military exhibit that, you know, ended up creating a lot of controversy in the way it was presented. And so, you know, they make mistakes, but they, you know, in the end, they did acknowledge them. And to be fair, you know, Germany still has a lot of issues. And I believe me, I watch out for my next book, The Roots of Racism, because I talk about all that. But the difference is that they have the monuments that are to the victims, right? They have the monuments that acknowledge that history. And we're just starting to have those monuments. It's funny because, you know, countries are not of a piece. So there are people in South Africa who don't like the truth and reconciliation process. There are people in Germany who don't want immigrants to come, you know, but there are large parts of the population that acknowledge and you know, want their government to do the right thing and will get out and march and protest. And so it's just like here in many ways. I would say, like I said, I think we are ahead in terms of the fact that we you know, we have a longstanding, you know, minority community and becoming less and less of a minority more broadly. But that is active, that is writing the books, that is telling the story. And unfortunately, I don't see that as much in Germany, but it's happening. Mm-hmm. I've been to Black European Studies conferences based in Germany, and that's why I'm writing this next book, The Roots of Racism, to look at the transatlantic ties that have been around since the 1400s, you know, 1500s, around the development of race and racism and slavery, and, you know, ultimately, you know, to where we are today, where you know, discrimination is still happening, even though they've had these truth and reconciliation processes. You know, discrimination is still happening in South Africa. So,
yeah. In this conversation and in your book, you have discussed how radical empathy can be applied by individuals and by communities, by society. Mm-hmm. Tell us this, since we're getting to the end of our conversation, how will we know that we've done it right as individuals, and how will we assess our progress as a society?
Well, the first step, besides the six steps I already mentioned, but you have to, if we're uncomfortable, right, we have to be willing to get uncomfortable to be able to, you know, get to that point where, because it takes stretching yourself and getting outside of your normal networks and the normal way you do things. And so I think we'll know we've gotten there. And it's going to be, I don't see that. Well, you know, the saying always is, in my lifetime. I remember when Barack Obama was elected, and a good, very good friend of mine was like, wow, I didn't think this would happen in my lifetime. And so I'm not going to say I don't think it will happen in my life, won't happen in my lifetime. But it's just something that's going to take a long time. And I think, you know, we can see examples of where, you know, maybe this is working. And I'm hoping to create one of those examples at McGill to say, you know, so I will know that we've got specific goals about, you know, how many Black faculty we want to bring in and Black students and so on. And I think we'll know we've gotten there when people, when we can, you know, I know everybody would love to just stop talking about race. And I think when we get to that point, we'll know we're there. But for now, it's going to take breaking down structures, right? And that is never easy. So,
what a good observation, though. We'll know we're there when we stop talking about race. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You would not have written this if you didn't have hope. you may say,
right.
maybe not in our lifetimes, but you also mentioned a very hopeful attitude very early in this conversation. So you must have some feeling that we can get there, that all is not lost. If you had to, in closing, tell us, what is the one thing every one of us can do right now to head in the right direction, what would you say?
I would say start off by, you know, and, you know, it's funny, I think people are afraid of vulnerability. But in fact, I believe that vulnerability makes us stronger in the end. And so I would say to everybody out there who's listening or who reads this book, you know, if there's only one thing you do, you know, be willing to look inside, be willing to be vulnerable and understand the way that things like structural racism have and bias have impacted you. Now, I hope you'll go the next six steps or five steps, because the first step is vulnerable. But, you know, even if you are willing to have that vulnerability to really understand your story, that's such a critical step. And if more people did it, I think we'd have a better society.
Terry E. Givens, author of Radical Empathy. This book was suggested by Vicki Lorini. Our podcast is produced by Jen Picard. Our recording and technical team included James Tejada, Tashina Brito, Christopher Feltz, Antonio Munoz, and Mark Jones. The executive producer is Joe Barr. Our theme song is from Pond 5. You can find more information about the authors and books at capradio.org/reads or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Donna Appadoni. Thanks for listening to Cap Radio Reads from Capital Public Radio.